Turn in your Bible, if you would, please, to the book of Job and to chapter 32. Perhaps we can look to the Lord in prayer. Our God and Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for your presence. Help us to understand that which you have given for our learning, that we might be exercised in the light of yesterday to be able to be the better even today. So deal with our hearts and our heads and our homes. All the ins and outs, the ups and downs, our work. God, just help us in every way as we look to you. And we'll thank you for that in the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. In our little bits and pieces of Job that we have done, in the chapter 32, when you hit chapter 32, and you go to chapter 37. That is all of the subject concerns Elihu. And it's his input. And all the way through from 32 to 37, as it were. Before that, the three friends of his are speaking. They are, as we studied, they are coming from the standpoint of not really seeing the issue, the problem. They're trying to be helpful. Without knowing it, they actually end up being a tool of satanic origin or suspicion. And they do that. And they're doing what they're doing. And if you would, over with me, just hold your finger here a moment. To Job chapter 2, just to pick up a thought. In the book of Job chapter 2, verse 11, we're told the purpose of these three friends. And if I may pick up at the end of the verse, for they had made an appointment together. The word making an appointment together is the same word you have in Amos 3:3. Can two walk together except they be agreed? Except they be together. It's used of marriage, etc. Agreed, together, a oneness. And it has to do with God and man. Israel can't walk with God, and God won't walk with Israel unless there is a wholehearted agreement. Here in verse 11, the end of verse 11, chapter 2. For they had made an appointment together, they agreed together, like that, to mourn with him, to pity him, and to console or comfort him. That was their purpose, to pity or to console Job. They came together. Here they are out, if you think of the Jordan River, and you go east of the Jordan River, that's this way, west of the Jordan. East of the Jordan. West is out California way. Actually, if you go far enough, you'll come to California. And then it's west. If you go east of the Jordan River, and you go out there, here's the Edomites down here, the Dead Sea, and the Edomites are over there. And out in that area and northward, off of the Dead Sea eastward, is where these people were. That's the place where Uz is. That's where Job lives. These people live. They live there. They're coming in. They are not just nobodies. They're pretty predominant people that know Job, who is a very predominant man. And they come to pity him, to console him. And that's what they're there for. We're also told if you would like, or you're still holding your finger, go with me to the book of Job 42. The book of Job in chapter 42. God, when he's finished with what he's doing, these three friends, they're called miserable comforters. In all of their trying to help one another and trying to help Job, they truly don't do the job. They're miserable comforters. And here in Job chapter 42, and in the middle of verse 7, the end of verse 7, for you have, speaking of the three friends we just mentioned, who sought to pity and console, for you have not spoken of me, that's God, the thing that is right, as my servant Job has. Job spoke rightly of me, you three did not. And Job is thus commanded or encouraged to pray for them. They can't do it. Would Job intercede for you? Would my servant Job, verse 8, my servant Job shall pray for you, for him will I accept. I will accept Job. I do not accept you three men. So we know where these three men are, and they have all their discourse. So when you're reading it, we know where they're coming from, and they're very intelligent, they're very knowledgeable, but they don't have it together properly. Job does. Now, with that in mind, back over, if you would, to Job chapter 32. Job chapter 32. We begin with Elihu. And Elihu, you know, these verse 1. So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. So the three men, three friends, have nothing more to say. So as we turn the rest of the history, as we turn it, we do not find those three men saying anything anymore. Because they considered Job righteous in his own eyes, and there was no sense in talking to him. Verse 2. Then was kindled the wrath. Kindled, the word kindle means to glow, to burn, to heat up, to fire up of anger, to be excited, to be moved. Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barakiel, the Buzite, of the kindred of Ram. Now you know that the Buzite, Buz, is you have Abraham, and you have his brother Nahor, and Abraham's brother Nahor had a son named Buz. And he, this fellow, Elihu, is connected to him. All of the friends, you wonder when it took place way back in the days of Abraham, because all these people, their relatives, where they're from, they're all Gentiles, there are no Jews, remember. They're all Gentiles, and they're out there in the middle of that Arabian desert. That's where they are. That's where this all takes place out there. If you would. And in verse 2, the end of the verse, Elihu was kindled, angered against Job, excited against Job. Job was his wrath kindled, burning. Because? Why? Because he justified himself rather than God. He justified himself rather than God. That's what he did. He looked to God. The word justified means to do something in a very strong way. Very strong, aggressive, earnest way. Powerful way. And thus the word means to justify, to make to appear, to declare just, right, true, upright, innocent. Job, because he justified himself rather than God, he centered on himself to justify himself. And the context gives us to justify oneself by arguments. As an accused person, he's being accused. And in process of being accused, he's going before the judge with his arguments, his case. He's trying to declare, are you guilty or innocent, Job? And Job is saying, I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I'm not guilty. And that's the setting, if you would. Elihu is not happy with that because Job is justifying himself instead of God. Would you also notice in verse 3, if I may, also against his three friends was his wrath kindled the burning. Why? Because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. They had found no answer, no reply. They could not pin down what's wrong. You're accusing him of wrong. Well, what is the wrong? You never told Job. All three of you never really told Job what his wrong was. And Elihu is against these three friends because they declared Job to be in the wrong, and they had condemned, and thus had condemned Elohim, condemned God. In the process of condemning Job for wrong, they didn't see what was happening. They didn't know what was happening, as we study. So they condemned God in the process. Now, in the light of that, would you notice, please, in verse, they had no answer yet. It condemned Job. They had condemned him. And they found nothing wrong in Job. Now remember the word to condemn, to find something wrong, just to give you a little help with that. It means to make, to be in the wrong, to overcome, to conquer, to be guilty, to be godless, it's used, to make willful mistakes. So they condemn Job for making willful mistake, for being as a godless person. He was to be held as guilty. But why is he guilty? They had nothing to say. Nothing to say. Now, in the light of that, would you look with me in chapter 32? I'm just going to give you a couple of thoughts because I'm not trying to do this whole book. I just got into this book a little bit because of the great lessons and because of my little eye problems that came recently. And I am doing that, like I'm doing a number of things, simply because of that. And I sort of got sidetracked. And here we are. I'm not trying to do all of Judges. I'm just trying to get a little of it. Obviously, I'm not going to get a lot of it. And I'm going to be longer in it than I intend. But I'm trying to make progress. When you hit Job, Elihu goes from 32 to 37. The last statements of Elihu, who is never praised, he's not praised. God never praises the man, and God never condemns the man. In fact, he never says a thing about him. Elihu honored God. In the light of honoring God, mankind disappears. God becomes the overwhelming person, and all we disappear. And there was nothing to condemn Elihu for, because he didn't do anything wrong. In fact, he did right. He was wrong, but he was right. As he ends his last speech, then for the first time, Job 38, God will now speak. God has not spoken to Job in this whole adventure until chapter 38. And all of the three friends and Elihu prepare the way for God to speak to Job. Now, let's see what he says. In Elihu's arguments and case, and Elihu means he is my God himself. And here is Job is to be convicted, Job is to be convinced. And Elihu's job is to convince and convince him that what he was implying to God, so by so strongly maintaining Job's innocence and Job's righteousness, in the process of maintaining Job's innocence and righteousness, Job was innocent of the awful implication that God he was making possible, the awful implication that God could be guilty. And Job, you must not give the message to the people, to anyone, to yourself, that God is guilty. God is not guilty at all. Not guilty. And Job is in dead earnest. So you've got a man that's in dead earnest to get things right with God. If you're just dialoguing and debating on bits and pieces, nothing. But when you find the heart that's truly trying to get to God, my, that's different. Job is dead in earnest to get to God. He is legally right. He's not wrong. He's legally right in the light of God. Legally right. And Job must take heaven fully, heaven's position, that God and God alone is righteous. No one else is righteous. The righteousness that you need to look at, Job, is God's. You're looking at your righteousness. You should be looking at God's righteousness. And thus to be worshiping God, trusting God. Nothing matters. The great conflict being resolved is far more involved, Job, than any given man with any given problem in any given place. What's happening then and now in the light of the world is greater than any given one of you or me, greater than anything in and about our life, greater than all of that, and greater than our ignorance of God. Our ignorance of God. It's more than our ignorance. We don't know. We're ignorant. If we say we know, but we don't know. And so here we are in the light of God, and what God is doing, Job, said Elihu, is greater than anything that concerns just you. And he's right on that. He's right. And he's breaking out. He's causing Job, who has a formal initial understanding of God, to bring God into the more of God. And you have to go, if you have a theology book, you have Schaefer's Theology, say, and you read the 7 volumes or something, and you read any others, wonderful. When you've done all of that, if you could even memorize that, when you've done all of that, you have to put it down and be ready for God to take you where you haven't been, to lead you into what you don't know, what you think you know, versus what you need to know. Job is moved from that position, and Elihu says, you've got to get beyond what you know and what you think. You can't just say, I have this and I have that creed, and that's what I go by. We need to be moved into an experience of something more. Experience doesn't always have a whole lot of words to it. Did you know that? When the peace of God that passes understanding takes place in your heart, do you know there's no words for that? What words are you going to use? How will you describe it? It passes your ability to speak of it. Is it real? Yes. Do you need to know it? Yes. Do you need to experience it? Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. You can't just read peace and God is a God of peace. I need to experience peace. And there's no words for this tranquilizing power that God does to the human heart. And so there needs to be an experience. And truth needs to be, understanding needs to be reared in experience. When I speak of peace, I'm speaking out of, using God's terminology, I'm speaking out of an experience of peace that passes understanding. I'm speaking out of experience of love that I cannot explain, that the length and breadth and depth and height of it is beyond me. It's greater than all of that. The whole thing is greater than you, Job. That's what Elihu says. And you need to be ready to experience it. Job was a man who will readily, in earnest, dead earnest, he's going to receive light, and he wants the right. He does. The truth will make you free, and that's where he is. Now, Elihu, he believes that God is absolutely in power, rightly in power, in authority. And Job recognizes that. He agrees with Elihu that God is absolutely right in authority. God rightfully has authority, and whatever he does and says is authoritative. It is. Job doesn't have a problem with that. So what does Job have a problem with? Elihu's hitting the target right, but he's missing what Job agrees with him. Well, what are you after, Job? What more is there? Let me tell you what more there is, said Job. What is the God of authority like? That's what I want to know. I agree he has authority. I want to know what he's like. What is God like? I don't understand his actions, what he's doing. In the light of my innocence, in the light of my honoring God, trusting God, I don't understand what God is doing. What is God like? I know he's authoritative. I want to know what he's like. What he's like. That's where Elihu misses it. He misses that. But Job has it. Job has it. Job knows what he's after. God having authority for his actions and the right to do whatever is not in question. But when he allows all this to happen to me, said Job, all of this comes on me to pass over me, above me, and on top of me. I want to know, where is God's integrity? Where is God's perfection? Where is God's person? What is God like to let all of this happen? I know he has a right to do it. I don't understand what he's like. What is God like? Do you know most people have a sense of God? God is somebody very big, very marvelous, beyond explanation, God. But you know, most people don't have any intimacy with God of what he's like, of what he's like. They don't have that. They talk of God, God, God. They pray like that. It's all right. But you know, they haven't got far enough yet to have that intimacy with God. Job had passed where Elihu was. He had passed that. He wanted to know what God is like. What God, what are you doing? What are you doing to let all this happen to me? You see. I want to consider you, God. I need to know. You got to help me understand you. It is God, not Job. God is the one that matters, not Job. Not Job. You know the great statement. You pick it up in Revelation chapter 5. In Revelation chapter 5 and there. And you may just hold your finger here a moment and go over there. Revelation chapter 5. God is the one that matters. And in Revelation, chapter 4, verse 11, just to pick up our thought, our word, in the great praise to God and honoring God, thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power. Thou hast created all things for thy pleasure. For thy pleasure they are and were created. Chapter 5. Who is going to open the book? Who is going to be able to finish the great drama of history, time? Who's going to be able to run it all together and make it come out right? And I saw, verse 2, a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy, there's your word again, to open the book and to loose the seals thereof? Is there someone worthy? I wept, verse 4, I wept much because no man was found worthy to open and to read the book, neither to look thereon. Is there anyone worthy? Job, you aren't. It isn't you or me or anyone else. God is worthy. God is the solution. God is worthy. And if you keep reading, you know, verse 12, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power, riches, wisdom, and strength, honor, and glory, and blessing. Worthy is the Lamb. Is there anyone worthy? Yes, there is. God is worthy. God is worthy. Back over to Job 32. And so in the process, Job, you can't, it isn't centered in you and your problem, it's centered in God God's the one that matters. God's the one that counts. And in the light of chapter 32, and that's a little bit on 32, 33, 34, it's the way to cover the Bible fast, 36, picking up our thought, this is Elihu's fourth speech, his second defense of God, as it were, God's justice, God's person, God's position are not for human challenge. Humans are not to challenge God. The great battle of Armageddon is the challenger by humans against God. He happens to be Lord, Master, Supreme, over all, in all. Therefore, said Elihu, leave it all with God. He is over all, in all, supreme. He's authoritative. He's Lord. But you know, Elihu, you're missing something again. You missed on the authority. It isn't on the question of authority. I want to know about God's person, the kind of God it is that does this to me. And Elihu, you're missing out again. What is it? Is God a master and Lord of all? Absolutely. What are you missing out on, Elihu? You're missing out that you need to have a personal, responsible relationship to God. You don't want to think about God in the wrong way. How do you do that? Well, let me give you an illustration. We go and take God's God, and we dump on our religious system preference. We dump our responsibility to God, to the church, to the religious group, and we depend on the religious group and the churches, depending on the background. We depend on them to be responsible for us. We're looking for the religious group to be responsible for us to God. That's wrong. We're looking for a book to be responsible. I have a book. I follow the book. Book of Mormon, Book of Science of Mind, even the Bible in the wrong way. And we're looking. And we're looking for something to be responsible. And that's wrong, Elihu, that's wrong. What's wrong? You have to have a relationship to God, a saving, personal relationship to God. You have to have a relationship to God that satisfies your understanding. You've got to have that kind of relationship. And if you don't have a personal relationship, then you got a problem. Job has a personal relationship, and he's trying to work out a personal relationship. No one else is doing it for him. He's doing it. It's him and God. God and him. It's we and God. God and us. Personal. Direct. Personal. It has to be that way. Chapter 36, verse 3. I will fetch my knowledge from afar, and I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. Now the word fetch, to carry. And what's he saying? What's Elihu saying in this fourth speech, as it were? He's saying, listen, I gathered information from all over the place. I have put together the best sources, the best arguments, the best information out there. I want you to know that I'm coming to you with the best group pile of information there is. In fact, verse 3, and will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. I am going to honor God in the process of this to be just and fair to God and to you. I will prove that my Creator is in the right. I will. I've got all kinds of information, all kinds. That's what he's giving, the arguments. He's gathered them together. He said, here's the case, Job. Your three friends didn't do it. I'm doing it. Verse 4. And then he gives his own credentials. For truly, certified is true, no falsehood. Verse 4. For truly my words shall be not N-O-T, be false. He that is perfect in knowledge is with thee. You know who that is? That's Elihu. He said, listen, I happen to be very accurate in what I'm saying. I happen to be very knowledgeable. God never rebuked him for that. God never rebuked him for that. He said, I have gathered the information accurately. I have presented it accurately. I have presented what's out there, what people understand, what I understand. I have presented it to you. I want you to know, verse 4, my words are not false. I am to be, you are to understand that I'm no liar. And his claim, one who is perfect in knowledge is with you. I am with you, Job. You ought to be glad I'm here. Chapter 37, verse 16. You're going to see that again, only this time it's used of God. Chapter 37, verse 16. Dost thou know the balances in the clouds, the wondrous works of him which is perfect in knowledge? Now, God is perfect in knowledge, and Elihu uses that word when he speaks of Job. He said, listen, I really know what I'm talking about. And God didn't rebuke him for that. He knew what he was talking about. He just didn't know it enough. He didn't know it enough. Not enough to truly help Job. Oh, he fired up Job and got Job ready. There's no question. His three friends didn't do it. But this fellow's got Job right hot under the collar, ready to go for God, to get to God. And God's going to deal with his heart. Chapter 36, verses 5 through 15 have to do with suffering. Suffering, what is that? Suffering is to make you learn, Job. That's what Elihu says. The purpose of suffering is God's school to educate you, to teach you. Verse 13. But the hypocrites in heart heap up wrath. They cry not when he bindeth them. The hypocrites, the godless people in heart, keep their anger. They never ask God. They never cry out to God intensively for help. And even when, the end of verse 13, even when God binds them, when God punishes them, when God tries to help them by punishment, you get a spanking so you know the consequences of what you're doing. They do not trust God. They stay angry. And when God punishes them, they do not ask God for help. They don't care, Job. Verse 14, they die in youth. They have a very short life. That is, they don't have a good future, better. The end of verse 14, they die in youth, and their life is among the unclean. Their life ends in shame. Well, let me give you the word that's there. Sometimes people try to make things a little softer than they are. And so when you come to the end of verse 14, their life of the ungodly, the godless, verse 14, is among the unclean. Well, who are these people they're among? And the word is a male prostitute. A male prostitute. The cult of the prostitutes. These people that are angry and will not, they belong to the cult, the group. They live among the prostitutes. That's where they live. That's how God sees it. Elihu says, that's where they are. They're godless people, godless people. Verse 15, verse 13, hypocrites, godless. And they live among the male prostitutes. Verse 15, he delivereth the poor in his affliction and openeth their ears in oppression. That's what God does. Verse, let me go down now. In the light of all of that, the meaning of discipline. What's the meaning of discipline? God uses the suffering of the one who suffers to rescue him. How does God get people to wake up? By suffering. God teaches people and allows them to suffer. God wants to make them listen. They don't listen well. God allows them to suffer. Suffering's all over the place. Germs are all over the place. Problems are all over the place. Why does God allow that? To get people to think differently. Where they're going is going to even be worse in suffering. So if you keep going in that direction, if you think this is hell, and it isn't. It isn't hell. Your life isn't hell. In fact, you know if you aren't saved, this is the only heaven you're going to have. So your life is a mess. This is your heaven. It's going to get worse. And if you're saved, you can say, this is my hell. This is the only hell I will ever know.
my pain, my problem, my suffering, my anguish. This is it. It'll never be again. You need to understand you haven't even started. You haven't even started. I want you to listen, said God. If you don't listen, where you're going to end up is going to be horrible. And you don't want to end up there. I'm going to let you suffer all these things so that you wake up. So that you learn. You're educated. Now, there's more to it than that. But that's what Elihu got. He understands that. Chapter 36, verse 16, going to verse 21. Job, God is trying to keep you from evil. Consider that your transgressions, and he says it right, consider that your transgressions were not the father of your afflictions. The transgressions did not cause the affliction. It is not because of what you did. That isn't why you're suffering, Job. He knew that. That's very good. Very good. But the afflictions, Job, did discover something. They discovered some transgression in you. They revealed to you your need for God's mercy and grace. The transgressions aren't the cause of your problem. But your problem has brought out your old nature that needs the grace of God. It has brought out your ignorance that needs the knowledge of God. Job, isn't it a wonderful school? A wonderful school. You are in trouble, Job. You're in trouble. You're always in trouble, and you always got an old nature. You never want to say you don't have an old nature. You don't want to ever say, I'm far enough away from trouble that I won't be in trouble. No, you're only a step away from being in trouble again. Now, in the light of that, what you don't understand, and you don't, God does. God does. Job, you don't have to understand everything. God understands it. That's it. Therefore, trust him. Wait. Don't worry. Don't worry. Wait. Don't worry. Don't get bitter. Don't get bitter. Chapter 36, verse 21. Take heed. Take heed. Regard not iniquity, for thou hast chosen rather. Thou hast chosen rather than affliction. Now let me put that together a little bit. Verse 21. Take heed, regard, and take heed, take heed. Do not turn to iniquity. Regard not iniquity. Don't do it. Don't do it. That which is forbidden, don't do it. Do not evil deeds. Do not become evil. Avoid sin. Turn your back on wrongdoing. Don't do it. For this you have chosen. Preferred is the word in verse 21. Thou hast chosen preferred. This word chosen preferred means to examine, to test, to prove. You have chosen this because of this and that, because of this iniquity, because of this experience. Be careful that you don't choose to go wrong when you should stay right. Because of this or that, you have chosen, you have been examined, you are being tested, you are being proven. Why are you being proven? To keep you from going wrong, Job. You got an old nature, and I could bless you and bless you and bless you and give you all the good things, and somewhere down the road, you're going to get clipped and go astray. I'm going to strengthen you so that will never happen. And God did. God strengthened Job. He did. He strengthened him. He tested him. Elihu says he has to be tested. God, you need to be tested. God needs to test you, Job. And in being tested, you're being educated. Now, in the light of that, would you pick up our word, the word chosen? Verse 21, thou hast chosen, thou hast preferred, thou hast been examined, thou hast been attested, tested, examined, proven, rather than affliction. You don't want to get, you want to stay in the side of being tested by the trial. You don't want to get into the evil side of it. Just be tested before God, rightly so. Chapter 7, if you would. Job chapter 7. Picking up our word and tying it together about Job and about being tested. He doesn't want to get into the evil part. He wants to be the tested part, afflicted, but don't get into evil. Thus, if you would, chapter 7, verse 17. What is man that thou should magnify him, and that thou should set thine heart upon him? What is Job's great, and this is Job speaking, what are you after, Job? God is constantly caring about people. Job sees man, he's looking at himself, he's looking at the world he lives in, he looks at his physical body from stem to stern, covered with boils and disease, and he's looking at it, and he said, man is very insignificant. Man is so insignificant, and so puny, and so nothing. Why are you bothering with us? That's his question. Verse 17. What is man that thou should magnify him, and that thou should set thine heart upon him? God, what is it? We're so insignificant. This should be reason enough, because of our insignificance, for you not to bother with us. Why bother with us? We're too insignificant. Why don't you put your attention elsewhere? We aren't worthy of your attention at all. Why is a human being so important to you? Why is that true, God? 17, the other half of the verse, and that thou should set thine heart upon him, to set thy mind, thy heart, a mental action, to concentrate. Why are you concentrating? Why are you paying so much attention, God? I wish you would not think so highly of people. I wish you wouldn't pay attention to people so much. I wish you wouldn't do it, God. That's what gets us in trouble, because you're so interested in us that you care whether we come out right or wrong. And God, it makes it very difficult. We're so nothing. Why do you bother? And then look at me, said Job. What am I that you should do all this to me? Am I worth it? Am I worth all the suffering? That's what this is for. Am I worth all the heartache, the headache? Am I worth all the suffering? Am I worth all the things I'm going through? Is it really worth letting all of this happen to me? And it is. It is. Verse 18. And that thou shouldst visit him every morning and try him every moment. Now you want to contrast, because the heat gets hotter. The strength of the statement gets more. Do you notice it goes from every morning to every moment? Not just every morning, every moment. Let me give you a couple of the other words. Verse 18, the first part. That thou shouldst visit him. The word to visit means to inspect him. To every morning you investigate. Every morning you pay attention to him. Every morning. If the word is used to discover, to purify silver, to purify gold, to purify it, the metal. You heat the metal up in order to examine it, to carefully examine it. Thus in verse 18, that thou should visit him every morning and try him, scrutinize him every moment. What kind of thing that was so personal to you that you pay attention to the hours and minutes and seconds of our day? What is it, God, about us who are so insignificant and so puny that you scrutinize us like this? What is it about us? What is it? Would you go with me, please, for a moment? Hold your finger here and go over with me to the book of Psalms, Psalm 26. Psalm 26. Just picking up our words so you can see it. Psalm 26, and in verse 2, listen to David. Verse 1, judge me, O Lord, for I have walked in mine integrity. That's like Job, isn't it? I have trusted also in the Lord, therefore I shall not slide. Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Prove me, prove me. There's your word. Scrutinize me, test me, test, examine me. Do you say that? Say, God, do you want that kind of personal attention in your life? Examine me, try my reins in my heart. I think I'm ready for it. I want to be ready for it. I want to grow. You know, I want to have patience, God. And God said, wonderful. Isn't that a good request? And then God lets everything happen that what? Test your patience, doesn't it? Everything goes wrong. Everything that can go wrong goes wrong. You reach for the cup and the cup spills. You do something else and everything thinks. It wins all over this. And you clean up this and bend down to do something and something else happens. Whoa! You asked for patience, didn't you? I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you. You see? God's very personal. And Elihu got the point, but he hasn't got it right, but on target fully, but he's in the ballpark. He's in the ballpark. Would you go back over with me, please, to the book of Job chapter 36. Job chapter 36. Remember we said in Job chapter 36, verse 21, the end of the verse, for thou hast chosen rather than affliction, is because of that, this iniquity, to regard not iniquity, that you've been tried by affliction in order to keep you, Job, from evil, from being tested. And that's why you're being tested, Job, by suffering to keep you from the evil. And the greatest affliction in all the world that you could ever face. The greatest affliction you could ever face, my friend, is not to be compared with the smallest sin. Did you know that? The greatest heartache, headache, pain, loneliness, and all the things you go through are not to be compared with one little sin in your life. One. All of that in its massive form that falls on your head is nothing. One little sin in your life is. And if that sin isn't kept in check, then it gets out of line and we'll get you. We'll get you. Chapter 36, verse 22. Behold, God exalted by his power, who teacheth like him. And Job lifts up God. Remember how great God is. Behold, look, see how God is exalted. He causes himself to be exalted, to raise himself up, to be honored. It's used of raising up a wall and raising up a tower and raising up a fortress. God raises up that which honors him and exalts him in his power. Verse 22, God is exalted by his power. And the second part of verse 22, who teaches like him? Who is a teacher? It's a rhetorical question. The answer is no one. In fact, as you're reading all around here, as you're going, they're all rhetorical. No one. Can anyone compete with God? No one. Look at verse, can anyone teach like God? No. Can anyone teach lessons like God does? No. You and I can try to help one another and teach them and encourage, and we can try to do that. But no one does it like God. No one teaches like God. You really want to grow? You want to know? Then God lets all kinds of things. Can God fix him? He could fix him in 2 minutes. He can fix anything he wants. I have different things. If you want a little test, I have different things that come and go. Different things over the... I say, I've got this problem. And I don't. I do my little part to get it checked or something like that when I need to. When I'm all done. They don't do anything. It's just there. Do you know what? And God in his goodness makes it go away. God just makes it go away. And it goes away. And then God lets something else. And I'm learning that God will take care of it. Even this. God will take care of it. Because that's what he does. That's what he does. He always does it. Are you capable, God? In fact, I thought you just don't want to share this with anyone. Don't tell anyone. But I figured out, this is just a, you know how you dream about things sometimes? I said, what a neat thing to work out if I, when I come to Job 42, that all of a sudden I wake up one morning and boom, it's all over. Now, I said, that sounded like a good thought to me, because Job finished the test. I said, I'm going to finish the test with Job, and then I'm going to be good. Now, I could speak, I said yesterday, I think I'll speak in Job 42 to speed it up. What do you think? But I don't want to speed it up. I don't want to speed anything up. That's the point. I don't care. I don't want to speed anything up. I want it in God's time and God's way and for God's reasons. I don't know them. But he does. And that's enough. That's the point. It's enough. God teaches like nobody. And when he's done with the lesson, he takes care of it. That's his plan. That's his purpose. That's him. No one teaches like God. No one. Verse 23. Who hath enjoined or imposed himself? Enjoined him his way. Who can go and impose and get in the way of God? The answer is no one. Rhetorical. Second part. Who can say thou hast wrought, worked, done wrong? Has God ever done wrong? Who's going to tell God he did wrong? No one's going to tell God he did wrong. No one. No one's going to tell God that. No one's going to say that to God. Over God, he's exalted, lifted up, high and lifted up. And we're puny and insignificant. We are, dear friends. We are, but being puny and insignificant, God happens to be immensely involved in your life. Do you know the most important thing? I can illustrate it. You know it better than I do, all these different things. Do you know how important you are? In the beginning, God created the heavens, Genesis 1:1, and the heavens and the what? And the earth was without form and void, etc., etc., etc. And then God created all of those things, and then he put man in it. He put man in his image and likeness. And you know when he's all done, he's going to get rid of the heavens, he's going to get rid of the earth. The earth isn't important, the heavens aren't important, the stars aren't important, the animals aren't important, they aren't important. What's important? You're important. And when it's all done, with everything he created apart from angels, the only thing he's going to take out of it are humans. That's all. He isn't going to save your dog, he isn't going to save your cat. He's just going to get you. You are the most important critter on the face of the universe right now. Do you understand that? To God. Isn't that hard, isn't it? But that's so.
I don't think he cares.
I suggest you get to know him a little better and spend a little more time. Bend your heart, bend your knee. Get to know him a little better. God does happen to be intently involved. And no one teaches like him. No one. Would you go with me, please, in your Bible? Over, if you would, to Psalm 139. Psalm 139. We didn't get very far, but you got a little sense. I tried to give you a little sense of the flavor of the arguments, the case. To have it. Wonderful intercourse together. But like in Malachi, God took note that they talked of God and feared God together. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. A psalm, what did I say, psalm? I'm 39, thank you. I'll be ready for another help in a minute. Psalm 139, Would you please let me pick up the thought? We looked at, tried, examined, scrutinized, tested. Like metal, metal is tested. In the heat, the greater the heat. Seven times over is silver heated. To get rid of the dross, each time you scoop it up and then you heat it hotter. And you scoop up some more of the dross until you've got pure silver. Tried and tested. Remember, Job will cry out the word that he's using. Job 23, verse 10. And when I am tried, said Job, I will come forth as gold. You see, he knows. He's there. The experience, though, it takes a bit of working to get it worked out. God cares. The affliction isn't the issue, Job. It's sin. That's the issue. Job, don't sin. Stay straight. No matter what the problem, stay straight with me. You'll never have a problem because of affliction. I can make that go away like that. But sin has its consequences. Psalm 139, you know it, the great Psalm, David, about all of the great goodness of God. The knowledge of God about you. You can't hide from God. Verse 23, search me, O God, and know my heart, and try me. There's your word. Put me in the crucible. Put me in the furnace of affliction. Put me in the place and know my thoughts. Why? Why do you need to try and examine me in the furnace? Verse 24, and see if there be any, what? Wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. God, I want to catch it before it happens. God, do a work in my heart so that the possibilities that could come to me that would ruin me, catch them ahead of time. Bring them out. Train me, strengthen me, so that they don't happen. God's doing that with Job, my friend. God's doing that with Job. God did it with David. It was the cry of David. Is it your cry? Oh God, search me and know my heart. Try me. Put me into the crucible. You say, boy, I got enough problems. But you know, what do you always know? That God will never give you more problems than you can what? Than you can handle. That's what you know. And God is faithful, isn't he? God will never let it be more. Never let it be more. No. Would you go with me, please, to Psalm 66? Psalm 66. May I pick up the thought? I was picking it up in verse 9. Verse 8, bless our God, ye people, and make the voice of his praise to be heard, which holdeth our soul in life and suffereth not our feet to be moved. A great God who takes care of us personally, personal involvement. Why are you so important? Because you are important. That's why. That's why. And that's why you yell at each other and provoke each other and pester each other, because we're that important. And most of humanity doesn't care 2 cents about how important they are to God. Verse 10. For thou, O God, hath proved us, hath tried us as silver is tried. Thou hast proved us, scrutinized us, examined us, as we looked at it in Job. Put us on trial, put the metal into the fire. And the next word is the same kind of a word. Thou hast tried us as silver is tried. Now it's the same God that keeps us, gives us life. It's the same God that cares. It's the same God that's very interested in us, wants to comfort us and encourage us. It's the same God who's letting all this happen. Verse 11, who brought us, God, thou broughtest us into the net. That isn't a very good thing. You're caught, you're trapped. Thou hast laid affliction upon our loins. That isn't easy, is it? No, but God let it happen. It isn't sin. God's helping you, preparing you. Exercise in it. Thou hast caused men to ride over our heads. We went through the fire and through water, but thou broughtest us out into a wealthy place. You brought us into a wealthy place, in the direction of a wealthy place. Remember, the root means to be in great abundance, moisture, over satiated, loaded. A sponge, not a sponge with water, a sponge so loaded with water that the sponge is so heavy with water that the sponge is, the water is just falling off the sponge. It's saturated, satiated. That's the word. God, you're doing all of this. You care about us, verse 9. Verse 10, are you going to try us? Yes. I'm going to let all these things happen? Yes. I'm going to allow these. Why are you doing it, God? To bring us, verse 12, into a wealthy place, into a saturated place. I want to bring you where you want. I want to get you to where you need to be. I want you to where you are. You're very important to me. I want to get you there. I want you to see it. I want you to enjoy it. If I may skip down to verse 16, come and hear, all ye that fear God, and I will declare what God hath done. He hath done for what? For my soul. You need to get in the place of what God has done for my soul. My soul. Wonderful thing that God has done for my soul. Now, in closing, would you go over with me to Psalm 23? And let me use this word wealthy one more time that you know. Psalm 23. Now you know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. But I'm going to skip down for time's sake quickly, if I may, to verse 5. God, thou preparest a table before me. The word table has to do with protection, fellowship, provision. And you prepare everything before me in the presence of mine whom? Thou anointest my head with oil. That is a sign of honor, a sign of love. Thou anointest my head with oil. You care about me. Thirdly, verse 5, my cup what? My cup run over, and there is the word wealthy place, wealthy. Overflowing, overflowing. More than enough. And you know, I'm not going to do it here. But you know when they fill the glass at the table, in the table of the household back then, they filled the glass with the visitor, the guest, and they would fill the glass.